Hello and welcome to Anger, Sadness, and Envy, the Rampancy Podcast. This is Narcogen, webmaster of Bungie fansite Rampancy.net.
And I'm Trindicut.
And this is show number 2 on October 27, 2007. Last week we talked about the first cutscene of Halo 3 called Arrival and the first playable level called Sierra 117. And this week we're going to talk about level 2 called Crow's Nest. One of the first things that probably strikes fans when they start Crow's Nest happens in the first cinematic, which is that we get two new voice actors for Halo 3. All of the voices in the first level and in the first cinematic are familiar. We get to see Sergeant Johnson, voiced by David Scully in all three Halo games. We get the Arbiter, who has picked up the same voice from Halo 2, which is Keith David. But for Crow's Nest, we get a brand new Commander Miranda Keys and a brand new Prophet of Truth. Trindicut, what was your reaction to these two new voices?
Well, the first time I played through, I remember I heard the voice and I'm like, we heard the first change, E3 trailer just before release, I think it was, where it had a lot of campaign footage and the rest of it, but Truth's voice, the new Truth, is playing over the top of that, the little vermin speech that he has. And it's sort of disappointing, you know. It's nice that they can find an improvement in that. I mean, I think Miranda Keys was changed due to some accent problems that they had, but it's nice to have the same character over again.
She had actually wanted to continue doing the part. She gave an interview with TV Guide that said that she simply wasn't asked back for Halo 3, even though she wanted to be. And she was told, apparently by Bungie, that the reason that was done was that they wanted to have Miranda Keys have an accent. Now, Julie Benz, who did the original work, was known for playing a character on Buffy the Vampire Slayer and the spin-off Angel. She's an American actress. And for Halo 3, they picked another American actress named Justice Boulding, who the only record that I can find is that she was just picked up by the American soap opera Days of Our Lives this past June, which is after, probably, that she did the work for Halo 3. Now, can you tell me, do you think the new Commander Keys has an accent?
No, not at all. I couldn't tell any difference. I listened to, you mentioned this this accent the other day, and I actually went back and played over it again and tried to pick up the difference, and it eludes me. I can't pick it.
I don't know. I have a feeling. I don't know if we'll be able to get a definitive answer about this from anyone, but I really couldn't detect that Commander Keyes has any accent, or at least not much of a different one. I mean, I'm not sure where Julie Benz is from. Maybe she's from the West Coast. Maybe Justice Boulding is from the Northeast or the Midwest, and so maybe there's a slight difference in the accent there. I thought overall the two voices sounded very, very similar. I think if you hadn't been paying attention, if you hadn't heard about that interview, you might not even have noticed that it was really that different. They both sound very young. I have to say, both voices sound younger than the character look.
I don't know. When I played through the first time, I was probably far too early in the morning, and I did have it relatively quiet, but you can still pick up on a bit of a difference. Like, it may not be the accent, it's probably more the tone of the voice, but it just didn't sound the same, especially when she was, you know, telling us, oh, we're going to war towards the end of it. It lacked the Julie Benz sort of effect, which you could sort of pick up on in Halo 2.
Well, okay. Do you think it's an improvement?
No, I don't think it is an improvement. I don't think changing voice actors can be an improvement, because you're better off recognizing the voice and going, hey, this is the same person. Taking in consideration that we're playing a video game here, and that every time you go, like every time we've gone from Halo to Halo 2, that you got an entirely new suit, which is, well, considering that it's only that Halo happens over a very short span of time, the fact that they made a whole, you know, markup of the original armor is sort of, it's part of the evolution of the game, and I just don't think voices should fall under that category at all. I think voices need to stay true from the start. It's like just like the Master Chief. If we had a different Master Chief voice, even if the movie goes ahead, we'd still need to have the same guy, in my opinion.
Oh, well, I agree with that. I mean, obviously, I don't think there's anybody else who can or should play Master Chief besides Steve Downes, and that's in the games, in the movies, whatever. I don't care where they do it. Because that character has no face, because he's only recognizable by the green suit and the helmet, it's the voice that completely makes that character.
Absolutely.
Despite how few words he actually says through three games, that's not really the point.
Have we got a word count of how many times he spoke? Because I remember playing through and I'm like, he didn't speak much this time, did he? And there's even, like, it even looks like in, we'll get to it eventually, but in The Covenant, it looks like when the Arbiter says something, we trade one enemy for another. It looks like he says something and he just turns his head back around. It's like, and he just doesn't say anything. It happens all the time. A man of few words.
Very few words. I'm not sure. It sounds to me like he actually gets fewer words in Halo 3 than he got in Halo 2. I haven't done a word count. If I have some extra time, maybe I'll try and do that. Suppose, I can see your point about continuity, that all other things being equal, it's better for the player's immersion in the game to keep all of those things consistent. You know, anytime you change a voice, you're drawing attention to the fact that, hey, this is a game. This is an artifact. It's a created thing. And it reminds you that these aren't real, you know, these are characters aren't real people in a real world. And so it does break your immersion there. However, from the other side, I could also see that, well, maybe Bungie did want to make a change. I wasn't so impressed with Julie Benn's performance as Commander Keyes that, you know, that I would have said that she definitely needed to come back, you know, barring all other considerations, the way I would say with Steve Downes. I mean, you know, I don't think there's anything you can say about Steve Downes' performance to suggest that they should ever make any kind of change. However, I'm not convinced that the problems with the character of Miranda Keyes come from the voice portrayal. You mentioned that line where the Marina asks,
"Ma'am, squad leaders are requesting a rally point. Where should they go?"
And Miranda just replied,
"To war."
That line sounds very much like a line written by Joe Staten. I'm not sure there are very many voice actors who can pull that off without it sounding terribly cheesy. In fact, if anything, that's the unique talent I think that David Scully, who plays Sergeant Johnson, has, is that they can write whatever kind of cheesy, cliché lines they want for him, and he just makes it work.
Oh, absolutely. I watched HBO put up all the alternate. Actually, we have Cody Miller to thank for it. Actually, he put up all of the clip alternates to the end of Arrivals and the start of Sierra 117. And he says there's probably about 8 or 9 different ways that the end of Arrival happens, and all of them are sort of pretty damn cheesy, and they're all sound really good. Also, he's a really talented sort of voice actor there.
Yeah, there's one variation where he says they must love the smell of Bulgari. And then says that, yeah. he can do product placements too. Moving on, the Prophet of Truth is an entirely different situation. I mean, this is a role that had an awful lot of meat. In Halo 2, this was voiced by Michael Wincott. Probably, depending on people's age, they may know him from different things. He was in The Crow. He was in Romeo is Bleeding. He was in Alien Resurrection. He was in the Kevin Costner, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves movie as the guy of Gisborne. He's got a very distinctive, gravelly voice. And as you pointed out, the new voice for the Prophet of Truth is in that E3 2007 trailer. And when you first heard that, did you think that was him? Did you think that was the Prophet of Truth, or
no,
who did you think that was?
I know, like, when I watched that trailer, the first thing I noticed was there was a different voice actor, and as generally speaking, I was disappointed to hear that, because I'd like to hear the same voice actors over in the next game, like I mentioned before. But it doesn't carry, like, if you compare it to Miranda Keyes in Halo 2 and 3, the similarities aren't the same between Truth in Halo 2 and Truth in Halo 3. Like, there's a distinctive difference in the voices. There's a lot of similarities, but there's more differences than I think any other change between Halo 2 and Halo 3. And it's sort of I just wish it was a bit more realistic in the way that I carry over those voices. Yourself?
Well, what I want to know is, when you heard the trailer, did you know whose voice that was? I mean, did you even know? When I first heard the trailer, I had no idea that it was a prophet of truth. In fact, I wrote some forum posts and say, nope, that's definitely not him. Doesn't sound anything like him. And of course, I mean, I was right to an extent. It's not Michael Wincott.
No, it's not.
I thought, people thought, well, this must be the replacement for Tartarus. It sounds more like a brute. You know, this must be a new brute chieftain. And of course, there is no replacement for Tartarus, actually. They chose not to give us a new head brute. We get brute chieftains as kind of mini bosses in lots of the different levels, but there's no brute character.
Well, I don't know. When I figured, given the circumstances of what we were seeing, when Terrence Stamp as Truth starts talking at the start of the E3 trailer, you can sort of tell. Well, I don't know. I picked up on it fairly quickly that it was a prophet, considering it referred to humans as vermin. That's just a bad title for me, but I can see where you're coming from there. There's a lot of I didn't really see too much about it. I was actually midway through doing about half a dozen exams at the time, so I wasn't really online much. But I did see that trailer, and I later saw a lot of the attention going towards just who is that person. That shouldn't happen. That shouldn't happen at all, I think, if it's a recurring character.
Ideally, I suppose it wouldn't. And we don't, unlike the change for Miranda Keyes, which was mentioned by Julie Benz in this TV Guide interview, I don't think anyone's actually said why this voice was changed, so we don't know. Maybe we'll be able to get an answer if I can swing an interview with someone at Bungie. It may have been that maybe Wincott simply wasn't available. You know, it may have been a scheduling thing. But one thing I thought I would do is I would see if I could try to get an answer from the Prophet himself. So what I did was I got in contact with the Prophet of Truth from Halo 2 and got him to speak for us for a few minutes about this change in the voice.
Your Holiness, the Prophet of Truth, welcome to episode 2 of Anger, Sadness, and Envy, the Rampancy Podcast. Perhaps you heard our first broadcast last week?
No!
Ah, well, fair enough. That's a very new thing, and it wasn't really promoted much in advance. Still, I'm sure a lot of people did hear it.
Are you sure?
Still, we didn't have you on to talk about the podcast, but to talk about Halo. Is it true that you were originally going to be in all three Halo games?
Each one from first to last.
And that originally, in Halo 1, you were just going to be an elite with a fancy hat?
This exchange of hats. How tiresome.
Ah, well, if you're reluctant to discuss that particular topic again, I think our audience will have to understand. More generally, what was it like working on a blockbuster game like Halo 2?
Each one created and consumed in times of extraordinary crisis.
An interesting, if cryptic, response. Still, I suppose that's why you're a prophet. So you went from a 3-game contract down to appearing in only one, and then you were replaced. Does it bother you? Did you ever get a good explanation as to why they made this change in Halo 3?
The council was overzealous.
I see. Well, councils can be like that, I suppose. Although I don't know if Marty likes to be called a council or a committee. Were you very upset at not being invited back for Halo 3?
These are trying times for all of us.
Well, I can understand that. Although for those of us just playing Halo and not living in it, I suppose it's a bit easier. Getting back to the game, though, since we first meet you in Halo 2, you're desperate to activate one of the Halo installations
and begin the Great Journey.
Yes, you call it the Great Journey. Although, we've been told since then that what would really happen is the destruction of all life in the galaxy. In retrospect, was that a good idea?
Are you questioning my decision?
Well, not as such, but I'm sure the audience would be interested in some of the behind-the-scenes action in your attempts to, well, kill everyone so that you can make yourself a god. Still, in Halo 2, you almost got away with it, and I think most fans had faith that you'd be returning in the sequel.
And see how how our faith has been rewarded.
Well, you do have a point there. Well, thanks very much, Your Holiness. We appreciated you taking the time to speak with us, and of course we'll have you on the show again sometime.
No, you will not.
Okay, so that was the Prophet of Truth from Halo 2, and here is the voice of the Prophet of Truth from Halo 3, voiced by Terrence Stamp.
For your destruction is the will of the gods, and I am their instrument.
Fans may know Terrence Stamp from way back in the 80s. He played the character of General Zod in Superman 2, who was a Kryptonian criminal imprisoned by Superman's father in the first movie, who then escapes as the unintended consequence of one of Superman's many rescues of Lois Lane. One thing that's in common between these two actors, both Michael Wincott and Terrence Stamp, they both tend to get typecast as villains. And they're both excellent, excellent voice talents, but they don't sound much like each other. In fact, I did not even recognize Stamp's voice as Truth, as being him, because it sounds to me like he's trying to imitate Michael Wincott a little bit. Terrence Stamp's voice is actually very strong and very deep. It doesn't have this gravelly. Michael Wincott's voice almost sounds like he's constantly got some kind of a cold or something, like there's a rattle in his chest. This is noise. It sounds like it's going over 9 miles of bad road. And Stamp's voice actually is very strong and very clear. But the Prophet of Truth in Halo 3 sounds very breathy, you know, almost like the guy is on a ventilator or like he's smoked too much or something. And I couldn't figure out whether that was just his characterization of of Truth, or whether he was trying to bridge the gap between his own voice and the earlier one so that it wouldn't be too jarring a change. But tell me this, though. Aside from the fact that it's a different voice, and you can tell it's a different voice, and that by itself is jarring, what did you think of his performance as Truth? I mean, if we had heard this voice in Halo 2, would we have felt happy with that? If things were reversed, if we had had Stamp in Halo 2 and Wincott in Halo 3, would we still be complaining or not?
No, I don't think so. I honestly preferred Wincott as the Prophet of Truth rather than Terrence Stamp. You're right, though. It's the raspy sort of gravelly sound that Wincott brought to it really, I guess it's first impressions. I can't really answer that question. I don't know if it would be the same, but I saw Stamp as Truth as sort of a step down from Wincott, purely just because of the way that his voice makes you feel and revere the prophets as a race, and sort of what they intend on doing.
Okay, well, again, there's been no official discussion of why the change was made. Like I said, it may just have been scheduling. However, on the commentary track for the Halo 2 cinematics, there is a short discussion among Staten, O'Donnell, and Jones about Wincott's performance as Truth.
This exchange of hats.
I love that line. It's coming up.
Poor Truth, he's so world-weary. He's got the weight of the whole Covenant on his shoulders.
Yes.
And I think one of the tactical errors we might have made, Marty,
of hats.
What?
Is in the world where we wanted to convince people that Truth wasn't the worst guy in the world.
How in the world was that ever something we thought would actually happen?
Don't get me wrong, Michael Wincott, genius performance.
Yes, but in the world where you feel like he was going to possibly be your friend.
Okay, so there we have it from Bungie. Nobody was ever going to think that Truth was going to be your friend, voiced by Michael Wincott. I admit that I had projected a lot of interpretations about what was going to happen in the story going forward in Halo 3, based very much, not so much on Wincott's voice, but on my perception of Truth's character. And I have to admit, I was completely convinced that Truth knew exactly what was going on. That all of these revelations that we experience, you know, we go through the first game and there's this revelation that the Flood exists, and there's this revelation that Halo is a weapon that kills everyone, And then through Halo 2, the Arbiter gets to have those same revelations. This idea that, you know, the Great Journey is a sham and that the Halo rings are going to kill everybody. I was convinced, I guess solely by the strength of Wincott's performance, that Truth already knew that and that he didn't care. That he did not really believe in his own religion, but it was a means to an end.
Yeah, I think I know what you're talking about there. Satan and was absolutely spot on. You instantly sort of get the feel that Truth is a sort of evil character. Having said that, in Halo 3, in the level, just before Truth dies, it sounds like it's more for his. It's not as evil. It sounds like a plausible explanation to his viewpoint on what the Halo rings are and who the Forerunners are, by providing a possibility that the Great Journey sent the Forerunners on a journey, and that's why they're all gone. Rather than having killed them all, they went somewhere else. It takes everyone else to a new life.
Yeah, and I would say you even get that a little bit earlier. I would say you get that right here in this cinematic, where Truth bothers to break into the UNSC communications in order to deliver his little diatribe, this little, you are all vermin speech. And it's very clear, like, I get the clear sense in Halo 2 that Truth is a conniver. I mean, he is deceptive. I get the sense right away from Stamp's portrayal, though, he's a zealot. He's like an evangelical preacher. You clearly get the idea from that speech that he believes all this stuff, which I didn't get at all from Halo 2. It's a big change for the character.
All things considered, if you had the ability, which clearly none of us will ever have, would you prefer Stamp or Wincott as Truth in Halo 3?
Wincott, without a doubt at all. But I have to say that going along with that, you can't just change that voice. I mean, if it's true that they chose Stamp over Wincott for this reason, because they wanted to change the perception of the character of Truth, then if I say I want Wincott, it's not just my saying that I prefer that voice actor. It's because I prefer that interpretation of the character. For me, I felt that if Truth was just a guy who was just as deceived as everybody else in the Covenant, in other words, he really believed this, that he was a true believer, that tracking him down and killing him was simply not going to be that satisfying. If he honestly thinks that there are gods who want him to do this, and that being a good prophet means doing that, then, okay, you might have to kill him to save yourself, but it's not going to be morally very satisfying. It's not a question of evil being punished.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I'm sitting here right now thinking, geez, he's on the money there.
Right there in this first cinematic, they get through the idea that this is not a trick. I mean, I had really projected a lot off of Wincott's performance. I thought, for instance, that the whole idea of the Covenant as this alliance between the elites and prophets was a ruse, that perhaps the prophets were losing the war, and so they made up this religion in order to manipulate the elites, that basically they were just, that the idea of getting rid of the elites had been in the plans all along. I mean, like, for 100,000 years, that basically they were looking just to get as far as they needed to make the Great Journey happen, and then they were going to get rid of these guys.
Well, could it be seen as something more than just the religion?
I suppose, but I thought I always saw it as the elimination of a threat. And the thing is, the only thing that makes the elites a threat is their removal from the council. All the things that Truth does. Why does he do those things?
It's mentioned in the Mysterium on the Legendary Edition. I don't know if you've had an opportunity to go through that.
Only briefly.
That the prophets and the elites have a history, have a negative history at which they were like elites and humans many years ago. It was prophets and the elites. They had a similar type war.
Well, true, but that war has been over for thousands of years. I think what I felt was the idea of finally betraying the elites really makes sense if Truth is a character who is completely and fully aware of what the Halo rings are, what they do, and what the consequences are. If he honestly believes that activating these things will somehow make him immortal or give him godlike powers, but that the consequence is that everyone else will be dead, then it makes sense for him to to get rid of the elite. You made this temporary alliance until you could eliminate your enemy and make yourself God. It's a way to get the last laugh. But I would prefer Wincott, and I would also prefer the old truth. Now, maybe they made this change just to make the story more straightforward. As it is, it was mentioned in several reviews that, oh, the story is too complicated and people don't pay attention to it anyway. I think I was expecting at least one or two more twists, because Halo 3's story is actually pretty straightforward. There is one twist, but it's actually quite predictable if you'd paid attention to the previous two games. I was expecting maybe one or two more twists. I also thought that Bungie was playing a little word game with us with the names of the prophets, and that was another reason why I was convinced. I mean, after all, we have the first prophet we see in Halo 2 is the Prophet of Regret. He takes a small force, attacks Earth, gets his butt kicked, and manages to escape and ends up at Delta Halo, and then has to apologize for this. In other words, he regrets his action. Or you could look at it that he's not being sincere in his apology, and so he doesn't really regret it. So I thought Bungie was playing a little game here. They'd be either playing with or against the type of the names of the prophets. But then you have Mercy. Well, Mercy is the one, you know, along with a regret, crying for blood when the Arbiter is sentenced. So, well, he's the Prophet of Mercy, but he doesn't show any. Or you could look at the scene at the end of the game when Truth leaves him, that Truth doesn't show him any mercy. So again, you could have these things, that this concept that's embodied in each of the prophets' names, that may be a statement about the plot or a statement about the character. So having looked at regret and mercy, which you can look at it one to be, you know, either way, either that it's, you know, the name is ironic or that it's literal, you could look at Truth the same way. The question is, okay, he's the Prophet of Truth. Does he know the truth or not? And that was another thing that led me to believe that, okay, this guy is way too clever. He's way too smart. He doesn't believe this stuff that he's talking about. He must know the real score. He must know the truth. And so it was a little disappointing in Halo 3 to find out that no, he's a true believer. He just believes this stuff for real. He doesn't know what the truth is. So I guess if the names were references at all, I guess they were playing against type. It's ironic that he's the Prophet of Truth because he doesn't know it, even though he believes he does. So moving on, there's another element that's in the Crow's Nest cutscene that Bungie has put into every one of the Halo games, either into a cinematic or into some combat dialogue, and that's the first scene where Marines in the base see the Master Chief.
Hey, check it out.
No way! A Spartan?
For real? You better not be.
No, man, he's here!
Wow, a Mark V or a Mark VI or whatever the Master Chief is in Halo 3, who's got the new suit but with a different number of dots on the glove. Yeah, we won't talk about that. Bungie seems to want to hammer home, though, how special and rare it is to be a Spartan. Now, something that a lot of the fans of the game who have also read the novels always wanted to see were other Spartans. There were a lot of people who either predicted that Halo 3 would have gameplay involving other Spartans, or wanted there to be other Spartans. But here again, these Marines are acting very much like the Master Chief's the only one. People who've read the novels know that, well, he's not really. I mean, there are other Spartans who are alive somewhere in the universe, and all throughout the course of these three games, there have been other Spartans elsewhere doing other things. How do you feel about that? You know, did you want to see other Spartans in Halo 3? Were you expecting there to be other Spartans in Halo 3? And were you disappointed that there aren't?
Having read the novels and understanding that there are other Spartans around, I mean, the Ghost of Onyx focuses primarily on the other Spartans and only briefly mentions the Chief. Sort of expected to see possibly the inclusion of other Spartans, but I've also noticed, like, in leading up to the release of Halo 3, on Halo3.com, the explanation of Master Chief was as the last Spartan. And you see that in the start of the instruction manual of Halo 2 and Halo 1. I don't know about Halo 3, I didn't read it. Bungie really carries the last Spartan sort of theme in all of the games and leave the other Spartans exclusively to the novels by the look of it. So I didn't really expect there to be Spartans, but I would have probably welcome the addition. Only thing being, just it would probably change the the importance of the Master Chief significantly, because, like it's mentioned in the novels, the Chief is the middle ground. He's not bad or great at anything in comparison to the other Spartans. Like, I think Linda is an amazing sniper from a great distance. The Chief doesn't have that, but he's still pretty damn good with a sniper.
Well, that's an interesting point. I admit, I had thought that there would be serious problems with gameplay balance if they were other Spartans, but I didn't consider the idea of specialization. I mean, you're right, the Master Chief is not a specialist, and so that's why his character is a good character for a player. But you're right, if they were to insert, you know, one of these other Spartans like Kelly or Linda into there, you would expect them to inherit the abilities that they display in the novels, and that might be hard to do. But then again, you do get a little bit of that. I mean, the Arbiter is a sword specialist, and back before the characters had names, Johnson was simply called Sniper Sergeant, and he carries around a sniper rifle for most of the time.
The Chief does have a specialization. It's featured at the start of the cutscene, Arrival. He's lucky.
Yeah, he's lucky.
That's what makes him different from all the other Spartans, is he's lucky.
Yeah, which is about the only element other than the ring that Halo inherits from Ringworld by Larry Niven.
But having other Spartans in the game wouldn't be, as you mentioned before, just prior to this podcast, having a half a dozen Spartans jump off the Pelican at the start of the scene there, those Marines couldn't say, hey, it's a Spartan, it's rather, hey, it's a half a dozen Spartans, and it would lose the extraordinary sort of, the extraordinary mystery behind them, I guess, or rather how they would be revered if it was one rather than six.
Yeah, I would say it loses all its emotional impact if you do that. If it's all of a sudden, well, here's a baker's dozen of Spartans, I guess we can just stay back at the base and let them handle everything. And as I said, I thought the other problem would be gameplay balance. I mean, after all, if you look at the way the game plays out on Legendary, Marines who are supposed to be weaker than you are actually tougher than you. You get Arbiter with you a good portion of the game. Only some of the encounters in Crow's Nest he's with you. The way they balanced that essentially was he's not completely invincible, but he can't die. In other words, he can be, if he takes enough damage, he'll get knocked down, sort of like a player would in cooperative. But then he'll respawn. He'll get up. What did you think of that mechanism? So we didn't get other Spartans, but we did get the Arbiter, who can be a player character if you're in co-op, or an NPC if you're playing by yourself. What did you think about playing with the Arbiter?
I think they found a good balance by ensuring that he isn't in the entire part of the game. There's part of Crow's Nest where he stays in the op center with Johnson, and he rejoins you for the jetpack brutes encounter. I played through on Heroic, and I didn't really pay enough attention to it at the start, but come the last couple of levels, I thought, gee, this guy hasn't died when I've been with him, and so I just went about and I betrayed him, and he died. Yeah, and just woke up shortly after the encounter finished, and I thought, well, that's a good feature, but I still think he should have died a bit earlier. You know, he should take a little bit less damage.
I played through the entire game the first time on Heroic, and I never noticed if he did. I never observed it. Maybe he went off, you know, because there are a few times when he goes a little bit farther ahead than I would like, which is true of all the NPC characters. There's always these encounters where you walk into a trigger volume and your NPCs identify a spot up ahead where there are enemies, and they immediately go there and get themselves killed. The Arbiter may have done that, may have gone up ahead, gotten himself killed, and then gotten back up again, and I didn't see it, but I didn't notice it. When I started playing on Legendary, though, I started to notice it, because he started to die before me.
I saw it a lot on Halo, the last level. Playing on Legendary, he went off and died. Oh, yeah, he goes off and dies a few times.
They do a neat little thing, though, which is that if he is knocked down, he just gets up. But if he disappears, he doesn't respawn the way a co-op player does. He appears using the camouflage effect, which, of course, you don't have access to in the game at all.
Yeah, which must be, it's sort of frustrating. I saw that on the very last level. On Halo, when you go to get in your Warthog and he just appears in the back seat, you're like, well, why didn't I have active camo when I played cooperative with my friend online? It's missing, but it's understandable. It's with active camo at your own discretion, it would change the element of, it would change the way you play the game. It would make levels like Cortana really, really easy.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the camouflage in Halo 2 on Legendary only lasted a few seconds, and so it wasn't really much of a factor. I think what it has to do with the fact is that with the addition of equipment, they moved the camo into equipment so that you could pick it up and use it when you want, instead of just, you know, not a power-up that you just walk over like it was in Halo 1 and it's activated when you walk over it, and not like a discretionary power on a timer that you can use whenever you want for a few seconds. I was a little bit surprised that they didn't have a more complicated mechanism for handling the respawn of the co-op players in that case, partially because I was so impressed with the way Gears of War did it. In Gears of War, both in the single-player campaign, where you have three NPCs who play with you, and one, again, just like in Halo 3, you can have a co-op player play one of those characters. If one of the characters is knocked down by damage, they go inactive.
They bleed out.
Yeah, they bleed out. They'll be out for the rest of that encounter unless you come over and hit a button to revive them, in which case they will continue fighting. So there are some interesting tactical choices created here. It's good to have the firepower from the additional characters, especially in some of the larger encounters. But it to go over and save one is a bit of a risk. I think I was kind of hoping that there would be some mechanism like that in Halo 3, that, okay, if the Arbiter... I don't want to see the Arbiter just be straight up invulnerable the way, say, Sergeant Johnson or Captain or Commander Keyes or any of the other, or Halfjaw or any of the other important story characters were in Halo 2. But if they're not, I would have liked to have seen some mechanism that explains that. Maybe if they had, you know, people would just accuse them of ripping off Gears.
The accusation of that would pop up pretty quick. I've played Gears of War. Actually, right before Halo 3's release, I went through and did the entire game on Insane. So I'm very familiar with passing out and dying and being revived again, unfortunately. I like that mechanism. No, it doesn't... Well, if you're playing by yourself, it just takes you back to the last checkpoint when you die, which, like, it eliminates that whole mechanism in single player by yourself. But playing cooperatively with other people... actually played that with a friend of mine who enjoys it when I die and goes back and kills all the people and then revives me when he feels like it. So it's a good mechanism, but it with campaign scoring considered, it probably isn't the best sort of addition there because it's really up to them to revive you. And
well, that could be easily solved. Just give a nice bonus equal to the death penalty for reviving a player, right? I mean, if you betray your cooperative player, you get a penalty. So if you revive them, you get an extra score. At the end of the day, they just kept it simple and straightforward. He takes damage. He's out for a short period of time. I haven't really paid attention to whether or not the same rules apply for respawning.
I found the respawn in combat in Halo 3 considerably different to the other two games. I know in the other two games it was pretty simple. I mean, if there was combat within a certain area, then you wouldn't respawn if shots were fired and they were going towards you. If grenades were being thrown, then you wouldn't respawn. In Halo 3, I've been in the interesting predicament of respawning and then being stuck immediately up, like within half a second, by a volley of grunt sticky grenades, probably six or seven of them.
Moving on to the actual level itself, we've got the level's called Crow's Nest, but all the action is indoors. The first level, we get some outdoor action, admittedly no vehicle. It's one of only two levels in Halo 3 that are all indoors. The second being Cortana, which is a different kind of indoor level. And this is also the first level to reuse geometry for more than one encounter. Now, Halo's got a long history of this. It's been part of some of the most scathing criticisms of the game. In Halo 1, you have entire levels which are reused. The entire game can be looked upon as a journey there and back metaphor, where you go out from the Pillar of Autumn until you reach the control room, and you make a journey back to the Pillar of Autumn, except now there are Flood to fight as well. So you've got Two Betrayals, which is the same geometry as Assault on the Control Room. You've got the Maw, which is the same geometry as the Pillar of Autumn. Now, the encounters are all very different. The lighting is different. Still, some people would look at that and say, hey, you didn't give me a 10-level game. You gave me an 8-level game or a 7-level game because of the reuse of geometry. And Halo 2 does a little bit of that. For instance, when the Arbiter is on the mining installation, parts of that geometry that are reused. And in Halo 3, we get the same thing again. Not here, but we get it later, in that the Storm and Floodgate are essentially the same geometry with some changes and the addition of the Flood. Here we get it inside the level itself, where basically you start off in this op center. You're sent out to various locations. You're sent to the hangar or you're sent to the barracks. And then you find your way back. So the op center is kind of this little hub that you go out, you do a mission, and you come back. And then you're sent out to another location. And then in the middle of the level, things are flipped off. You go back to those same locations again. You find your way out a different way. And then you go back through the op center one last time. And then on your way out.
Back to the hangar, in which you've already been to before.
Right. Right, back to the hangar. Is this good design, or is this just laziness?
Well, I think in this particular level, it's not too bad, given that it's got a good plot to go with it. Rather than just going back through the level like Two Betrayals in Halo, in the first Halo, this is actually sort of, you got to go out and defend the hangar, and then the barracks, then there's that god-awful brute encounter.
And the motor pool, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Actually, right near the op center. It may be considered lazy, but I think it still adds a certain element to the game. I mean, you know the base. You get to know the crow's nest that you're in. It's realistic. You're not going to go one path through an entire defending a single base. You're not going to go a single path because they'll come back and they'll fight that area again. That's just how war is. You know, they'll assault the hangar. You'll fend them off and go and fend something else off, and you'll have to go back to the hangar again because I'll try again. In that respect, it's realistic. In gameplay, it probably isn't that favorable because you're doing the same thing over again. Repetitiveness isn't really looked too kindly on in first-person shooters, I've noticed.
And once again, we're rescuing helpless Marines.
Yes.
Which again is a theme over and over again. Which I suppose is understandable given your special status that you're going to be able to go through these fights better than the Marines, and so they're gonna need your help. I like the layout of Crow's Nest. I think the way they reuse the areas for encounters done in different ways is actually quite clever. I didn't really think it was lazy to do that, and I think you're right. It does makes it feel like a real space. Each one of these spaces feels like it's part of a real place, and it has a real purpose. You know, you've got the Pelican pad, and you've got the hangar, and you've got the barracks, and the op center. And they make sure that there's always something going on in these areas, and you get to have like two fights in each one, or you get to go through an area later and see things that have happened. I mean, there's that corridor you go through, for instance, where it's mostly empty, and then you go through it later again, and everything is on fire. I thought that was nice. What occurred to me, though, was that not so much that the reuse of areas within the levels was an attempt to get free gameplay time and make the game longer, but more that the entire level was like that. I was struck with the admission during Halo 3's development that, yeah, there were levels cut from Halo 2. Halo 2 wasn't supposed to end where it was. You were supposed to return to Earth for a final showdown battle. And it just occurred to me that, well, if they had actually, originally thought that they were going to bring the entire story to a conclusion within the context of Halo 2, that you probably wouldn't need a battle like this, an assault on this indoor base. And I couldn't help thinking that really this is just prep, We came on Truth's ship, we jump off of Truth's ship, and now we're supposed to catch up with him again sometime. And so we've got the jungle level, and we journey to the base, and then we defend the base, but we abandon the base. I thought maybe that it was just, okay, we're just marking time. We're just inserting some levels. And that was how I felt basically about Uprising, which is this level where you're supposed to be going on a mission to recover the index. But of course, Gravemind doesn't teleport you right there where it is. He teleports the Master Chief right into the room on High Charity where the prophets are. But with the Arbiter, they just kind of put him off on this cliffside where you can see the control room, but it's essentially two levels away. And the only thing you have to do in this admittedly very beautiful level is kill brutes. Actually, the mission goals for that are just like, kill some brutes, kill some more brutes, revenge yourself on the dirty backstabbing brutes. So you get the same thing here, which is like, go rescue some Marines there. Go rescue some Marines here. The bit with the bomb, I suppose, is kind of nice. In fact, for me, there's actually a whole Empire Strikes Back vibe here. You know, there's no snow, but it's the same thing. You know, you're holed up in your base, and they find you, and you have to help people escape, and then you have to blow up the base, and then you have to get out yourself.
Yeah, I haven't really looked at that from perspective. I mean, when you look at the broader scope of all the levels that you go through in Halo 3, I guess that's probably not the most relevant one, being that you do go in there, defend it, and then abandon it. But I think it adds, Bungie try and make the game suitable for people who haven't played Halo 1 and 2 before, and I think this is really evidence of that. It's really sort of an introduction to how you work with your team, how you work with your Marines and the Arbiter, and you are introduced to different types of brute. And I briefly mentioned it before, that brute encounter with, I think, I counted the 17 brutes.
That's a lot. That's a lot of enemies.
And when you're playing through on Legendary, that brute encounter can be quite irritating. I think it's the choice word I'll use.
It can be, and I have to admit, I played through that the first few times on Heroic and then even to Legendary before I even noticed the gravlets directly in front.
Oh, I know exactly what you mean there. I played through, and I just tried, and I think I had about 30 attempts without, like, I knew they were there, but I'm like, well, what can I use them for? There's an exposed, you know, rail above me, that's about it. And then I realized that I can use that and get up and find cover with grenades.
Yeah, there's cover and weapons, and there's a shotgun up there. And I would say that's just like the final encounter of Sierra 117, where they've given you a sniper rifle and they've put you up on a ledge, and if you're a conservative player, your first instinct is to stay up there as long as you can before you drop down. Because once you drop down, of course, you're trapped. I think they try to push you off that fence. Rockslider was posting in the HBO forum about that encounter, that he started to get pissed at the game because of the Jackal snipers in that level. And of course, he played through Halo 2, but gave it up very early. And so for the last 6 years, he's been playing Halo 1 without Jackal snipers. And so they put two Jackal snipers and a carbine Jackal on Legendary in that encounter, I think mainly to tell you to get off that ledge. If you drop down into this little room, all there is this, what, four or five grunts in this little room, but the room is covered. I think that the grav lift there was supposed to be the same kind of thing. They're like, look, you can try and stay in this entryway, but all these brutes with brute shots and grenades are just going to blow you out of that hole.
And if you piss off the brute chieftain enough, he will come and beat the crap out of you.
Oh, yeah, he will follow you. But I was also kind of elated at that bit because, and he doesn't do it every time. I thought that was really great. I mean, sometimes he'll wait until you've killed off everybody else or until you've attacked him. And sometimes it just seems like almost randomly he will just charge at you. You see this guy charging at you with this hammer and invincibility, and grenades slide right off his armor. Bungie does try to give you that little incentive to say, okay, look, come out of your little hidey hole. Come into the encounter. If you jump out there, you can get the grav lift, you can go up, and you can get into this other area of cover. But, of course, the brutes will come up to that doorway and flank you. So they try to invite you into the encounter. You know, I mean, you still have the option to hang back if you want, but in some cases, I think you're going to be a lot less successful.
There is probably a couple of dozen people who will listen to this, and they'll go, there's grav lifts? Oh, my God.
It took me a long time before I noticed them. I didn't notice them until after I had killed everything, because the first playthrough, I was killing everything, and then I was exploring the room afterwards.
What you were saying before about, you know, inviting you to move into the encounter rather than stay back playing conservatively is absolutely true. I mean, I tried to play conservative down on the bottom. I'd kill a few brutes in my little hidey hole, and then I'd see a red dot on the radar. I'm like, oh, good, another brute. I'll walk around the corner, and there's the brute chieftain swinging his big hammer at me. And it's game over. You can't really do anything. You turn around, and your face is crushed before you can even turn around again. In that particular encounter, I mean, you move the grav lift up, and you actually do the same thing, though, up on the top. It's a conservative sort of gameplay. I found myself that the way I did it on Legendary was jumping across from one side to the other so I could get more grenades. There are some weapons on, like, there's certain weapons, certain equipment and grenades that actually constantly respawn.
That's another element, I guess, that they introduced in Halo 3, the idea of this weapon rack. There are no actual emplacements of ammunition anymore. In Halo, you could pick up weapons, but you could also pick up ammunition. They would just be, you know, clips of ammo lying out on the ground, and you could pick them up. And Halo 3 doesn't have any. Every time you pick up ammunition, it's in a weapon. But sometimes you pick up a weapon in a gun rack. And some of these gun racks, I don't know if the weapons respawn or if they're just infinite, never seem to run out. And there are some of them up on the upper levels of that encounter. So there's battle rifle and a shotgun in there. Yes, they've drawn you much closer to your enemies, but then they give you a close quarters weapon. So moving on, I think we're going to have two recurring features in the podcast. One of them we're going to call Anger, Sadness, and Envy after the podcast. It's going to be one element of Halo 3 that makes us angry, one element of Halo 3 that makes us sad, and one element of some other game of which we are envious, some feature or some element that we wish that Halo games had that they don't have. Starting first with Anger, I guess I'm going to pick the encounter we just talked about. Somehow it escaped my notice when I played through the first level, but the brute chieftains who have either a hammer or a fuel rod gun, who have armor that is invulnerable to grenades, and who have invincibility equipment, so that basically when this guy runs at you with a hammer, you can't stick him. And he is invulnerable. Okay, I understand that things need to be challenging, but to me that is way worse than any jackal sniper.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. My anger, my little anger topic is that exact encounter. The dozen brutes encounter right after going back to the ops room. Definitely, the pilots have made me really angry. I think I almost broke the controller from playing that on Legendary.
The first time it happens, it just feels so unfair, and it feels arbitrary, the same way that having jackal snipers you couldn't see could kill you in Legendary in one shot, even if they sniped you on the toe, feels unfair. You know, once you've triggered this guy who's coming at you, he's got his invincibility on, and he's got a hammer, you know you can't stick him. There are very few options you have. In fact, I think with the invulnerability on, they're even not vulnerable to being assassinated. So even if you're able to maneuver, you know, if you're able to get him to miss and you're able to maneuver behind him, you can't even get a kill that way. There's really almost nothing you can do except die and restart the encounter and hope he doesn't rush you or pick him off before he gets there.
As for sadness, we both share the same sadness in not having Wincott's truth.
Yeah, no Michael Wincott. Not just the voice, but to have a devious truth instead of just a delusional truth. I think I would have preferred that. So, Envy, back in 2004 when Halo 2 and Half-Life 2 both came out for the Xbox, I played both of them, and I have to admit that the gravity gun is about the most fun I've had in a non-budgie game ever. Being able to edit multiplayer levers in Forge and being able to pick things up and move them and spawn items is also a lot of fun. But there's just something very satisfying about being able to pick up any random object and throw it as a weapon. I wish I could get that weapon into Halo and then just go play with levels.
Well, as for my sort of envious, I don't really have much in the way of envy. I mean, I thinking about it a bit yesterday and today, the sort of marine cooperation that you have in other games, there are a few. Battlefield 2, the allies that you have in deck will listen to your commands and they'll go ahead and attack certain rally points in the multiplayer. As well, I'd like to see that sort of coordination in, like, even from the novels of Halo, you see Master Chief's able to coordinate with the Marines fairly easily, but there's just no evidence of that in the game, and I sort of wish that they sort of had that there.
Actually, that's another feature that Half-Life 2 has that Halo doesn't have, is that you are able to direct your allies to go to a certain location just by looking at it and pressing a button. However, I have to admit that seeing how well that worked in Half-Life 2, which is to say that it doesn't really, I can see why Bungie kept that out. Just as frustrating as it is not to be able to control Marines, I think it's twice as frustrating to have the ability to control them, but then have it be so unwieldy that, you know, you're getting your Marines killed so often that it would be better if you couldn't control them. I just wish, actually, there was a button you could make to stop them. That's actually all I want. I would just like to be able to freeze them dead in their tracks to say, look, okay, you know, you're going to get killed if you go around that corner. Stay here. Another feature we're going to do is a glitch of the week. Now, there's a poster over in the BungieNet forum called FogFun11, and he's posted an interesting glitch. We'll put a link to this on the site. There's a way in Forge to be able to use a weapon as when you're in editing mode as the monitor. What you do is you go to a level, you remove all of the objects, including all the spawn points. You then add one spawn point, and on top of that spawn point, you put every fusion core that you can place, except one. You hold the last fusion core above the pile, and then you have your second player, who they say the second player should have a bad net connection. You should have that second player drop the last fusion core while you're standing on the spawn spot, and this will trigger an infinite explosion, whereas the fusion coils will explode, and before they can all explode, the first one will respawn and will continue to explode. Basically, it's to cause an object overload to try and confuse the Halo engine. While that's happening, your second player, after having dropped the fusion core, should leave the game after you die, but before you respawn. When you respawn, you won't be able to see a weapon, but you should be able to pick up weapon, and you should be able to use them. And if anyone has a suggestion for a glitch of the week, we'll post an email address on the site. You can send us a link. Please, if possible, include a Halo 3 saved film.
And with that, I think we've concluded all of our discussion topics for the second level of Halo 3.
Okay, so we'll be back next week with Level 3, Savo Highway.